Subway everyday value means many mouth-watering piled high favorites are $5 footlongs, like the fresh-toasted tempting meatball marinara. And made-to-your-order BLT, the $5 footlong anthem rolls on only at Subway, where great everyday value lives. Subway, eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, Friday edition of the BS Report. We are taping this a few hours before Game 3 of the Lakers-Rockets series, which I love because it has brought back all the things that I grew up on with the NBA playoffs. Physicality, elbows, guys getting thrown out, teams not liking each other. And the architect of this violence, Rockets GM Daryl Morey, what's happening?
Round 3 tonight.
It's great.
Yeah, I also am amazed we're now the tough guys, but I think that's somewhat because the Lakers have been beaten up for not being tough guys for a while, so we have to be the villain created by the media a little bit.
Yeah, and you're the architect. You're Dr. Evil. It's all you.
Anyone who's seen me on the basketball court knows that's probably true. I had no skill, so I only got by on elbows and guile. So.
This is a big series for you because in game one, when Yao went out when he banged knees, you got about as much face time as I think a GM has ever gotten. And I thought one of your finest, it wasn't even acting because you were genuinely concerned, but I thought a best supporting actor in your future, maybe.
Well, if I'm Marceau or whatever, I don't think I had any speaking role, but maybe they'll give me a bigger role next time.
It was a brooding intensity as you stared at your 7'6" center saying, "Oh my God, not again." But then he came back. It was inspiring.
As I stared at my season. Yeah, well, he went down in a Jenga tower in a crumpled heap, and it looked bad. And I did see the video, and I had some hope that it wouldn't be too bad because it didn't flex. But I was worried it might have fractured because they hit pretty hard.
Right. You know what's interesting is that Kobe is 6 foot, I think, 5, and Yao is 7'6", and somehow they bang knees. That was never explained to me how that happened.
Kobe is actually surprisingly not big. I mean, just having been around Tracy McGrady and Paul Pierce and LeBron when I was in Beijing, it is surprising. Kobe has done an amazing things with that body. He doesn't have the freaky body like some of those guys I mentioned.
No, and I after seeing him in person a few times, he's listed as 6'6", but I don't see it. I think he's like about 6'4 and a half. Seems a little more realistic for me.
Well, he plays big. He plays big. I'm hoping we've got this series to where it's sort of like the Portland game where they're not winning unless Brandon Roy had a big, big game. And I think, you know, with the way we're playing right now, and we hope we can continue it, you know, Kobe's got to have a big night or we're going to probably do well at home here.
Right. And, you know, I never talked to you before this series about your strategy, but after I watched game one and I wrote the little retro diary about it, like, it's pretty obvious what you're doing. You're going to make the supporting guys beat you, or you're going to put Kobe in a position that he's going to shoot 30 shots a game, maybe be stubborn, and try to take these guys 1-on-3. You want him to either do that, or you want him to pass to Derek Fisher, Ariza, Farmer, whoever, and have those guys beat you, correct?
Well, I was proud of the retro diary because we took you out of walking your dog.
Yeah, you did.
And some pop TV show I haven't heard of.
The Hills, you know? Yeah.
I've heard of and never seen. So I was proud that we woke you up and reminded you like the NBA and got you to write a diary. So, yeah, I think, frankly, it's been a long tradition at the Rockets. I think one of the go-to defensive strategies, even back when they won the titles and they made KG do everything, is, you know, we'll often let the star, you know, have his way, but we try and limit the supporting cast. That is one of our strategies throughout the year. We did it with Chris Paul. We did it with Brandon Roy. And I think, you know, obviously that's been our strategy with Kobe so far. And one for one.
Yeah, you went 1-1, but that's good. You only had to steal one in Los Angeles. And plus, you watched the Celtics do this last year, and this has been a recurring theme with Kobe. He did it in the 2004 finals. Detroit put him in that position, and he just basically shot them out of the series. Last year, I thought he was a little more unselfish. He just didn't play that well. And I think, all the – just having guys constantly jumping at him, and I thought he just wore down as the series went along. And I think the longer this series goes along, maybe he wears down a little. I don't know.
Kobe seems like the one guy. I did feel like that way with Brandon Roy, and it certainly seemed that way with the Celtics. I do think we did take a lot of tips from the Celtics last year.
Yeah.
Obviously, Tom Thibodeau was an assistant here at the Rockets, and he devised a great game plan. Our guys, it's a little different. We're bringing a little less help because, I think Shane and Ron are, better defenders than what the Celtics had. So we're bringing a little less help, but we're trying to make it hard on him. In game one, it worked. Game two, we tugged on Superman's cape, and he made us feel the pain a little bit, but we feel like he's going to have to do that. And we had a good game too when Yao really had his worst game of the playoffs for sure, and maybe the worst game in a couple months, frankly.
Yeah, actually, nobody played well, really. Who played well?
Carl Landry.
Yeah, guys, your fringe guys, none of your big guys who get points. Nobody really had an – Aaron Brooks didn't have a good game.
No, it was really – actually, Carl, Chuck had a huge game, Chuck Hayes. It was sort of our bench kept us in it. Mm. The rest of the guys were just pretty good. Ron had a good game. Sorry, Ron.
Yeah,
Ron,
he did.
Ron's had about three straight good playoff games here.
But he got thrown out.
He did get thrown out, which, I did talk to Ron after, and he knows, they're obviously dying to throw him out of the game. He's obviously got the reputation. He's got to be more careful, and we need him to win. I mean, we brought him in for a reason, and, he's got to be smarter than to run at Kobe like he did.
Well, and we've talked about this. Ron's reputation precedes him at this point, and probably fairly so since he went into the stands 5 years ago. But, you've had some situations this year where he's gotten teed up for things that he didn't even do. You've had teams doing stuff to him and him kind of just reacting and people just, referees just seeing him and saying, oh, yeah, Ron Artest spectacle.
That's right. And I'd say Ron, he's still a very physical player, and so it there's always something happening. I mean, even the play where Kobe elbowed him, Ron was, it was a fight under the boards for the rebound, and Ron basically can move Kobe wherever he wants. I mean, he got him by like 50 pounds. So it's tough for Kobe. Kobe was doing what he's a competitor, and sometimes it manifests himself in, elbows that get him suspended. I think that, he's had three, and, that could have been his fourth, but the league didn't think it, rose to that level.
Well, we both played basketball back in the day. We're both washed up.
I was washed up before I started.
You compete on a court, and you're competitive guys, and you're banging bodies, and you're going to get mad at each other. That's basketball. That's the way it works. I don't think a lot of people realize that. Like, I think people, at this point, honestly think Kobe and Ron Artest despise and hate each other. I don't think it's that bad.
They actually really like each other. In fact,
I think they're competitive.
Yeah, Kobe's pushed Mitch to trade for Ron quite a bit throughout his career. I think Kobe's always felt a guy like Ron would add something. I think, it'd get allow him to take it a little easier on the defensive end when he wants to. So I think Kobe's always been a big fan. And you saw there's a lot of mutual respect, even in the post-game comments of Kobe feeling like Ron shouldn't have been thrown out and Ron saying the same. And, we just got in Shane the same way, having grown up on the bad boy Pistons teams. He's not saying anyone should get thrown out. I think all the competitors in this series, and there are quite a few, they're all saying, hey, this is just playoff basketball. Let us play,
The league is so afraid of it, though. And we saw the Celtics-Bulls series Game 7 just get ruined because the physicality of the two previous games, it was clear that they told the refs, do not allow anything to happen. Overreact if you have to. And it turned into a free throw shooting contest. I kind of feel like that is maybe where tonight's game is headed, game three. And, I think they're going to be so worried about anything.
Yeah, free throw shooting contest works for us. I think it's fascinating. You know, we were at what at the MIT conference you called Darkapalooza, that the NHL at least seems to be going the other way. Like, you know, Brian Burke, who's the GM for one of the most prominent teams, the Maple Leafs, he talked openly about how he wants guys who fight. That's why people buy tickets. You know, it's just it's very interesting. They don't have any like automatic ejections or any of that, and they sort of let it go. So you get the jersey pulled over the head. It's very interesting the different directions the two sports have taken. And you know, I trust the direction Commissioner Stern's taking us, but I think there's definitely an argument to be made to go either way.
Well, I think the real problem that happened was when the bad boy Pistons started it. Riley's Knicks escalated it, and then it reached a point that people were trying to be physical as part of how they were trying to win.
And well, I thought Fratello's Cavs, which was a team, and then the Knicks in the late 90s just took it over the edge. That's where
that's the thing.
Commissioner felt like. And I think that Fratello Cavs team was all because
them.
Those other teams were somewhat skilled.
Yeah.
And this Fratello Cavs team, no disrespect to Mike, who's a great coach, he was just going with what could help him win basketball games. He'd slow it down, beat him up. You know, every move across the lane was a full body check. And I actually, to be frank, I like the direction the league has gone in allowing more freedom of movement. We think it should be allowed more in the big area. Mm. I just think, overall, though, I do think there are some fans that like the physicality.
Well, it's part of the game. And, you know, when you play basketball, somebody's going to elbow you. Somebody's going to hit you in the stomach. Somebody's going to jump up and accidentally clock you in the head. You're going to get mad. You're going to get mad that somebody boxed you out and he stuck his bum into you a little too hard. It's just part of the game. And for whatever reason, they're so afraid of another Kermit Washington punch, which, by the way, now it happened 31 years ago. And this is really the only time that a guy got seriously, seriously hurt from a punch in an NBA game. And if you've ever read anything about the punch,
I read the great book, The Punch. Obviously, it's part of Rockets history, so I try to.
Yeah. Well, that wasn't a very good book about. I mean, I didn't really like that book. Breaks of the Game had a better breakdown of it, but
okay,
it was the perfect punch.
The author. So
it was a 6'9" guy whirling around. You had a guy running toward him with his hands down. The guy had time to plant his feet and throw, you know, basically the perfect right cross and nailed him in the perfect spot of his face, and then he fell back and hit his head. I just thought that was like a once in a lifetime moment, and it seems like the league has been slowly overreacting ever since. And then finally, I think the JoJo English Derek Harper fight that spilled into the stands and Stern was there, that was the tipping point. When that fight went into the stands, Stern was like, that's it. We got it. And now it's to the point where guys can't even jaw at each other. It's depressing.
Yeah, I think Ron was then the quintessential example of how serious the commission will be. And, that one probably.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot.
Deservedly. So, at some levels. So.
Well, you've gotten to know Ron really well. You really, really like him. And I can't think of two guys that have less in common than Daryl Morey and Ron Artest. I mean, literally, I can't.
I think, yeah, it's true of, I'd say most executives. It's hard to relate to a lot of the players. You know, you sort of have food and basketball. Those are the two things to talk about. But I do think Ron, he's a fan favorite. He's a fan, everyone here loves him because he's one of those guys, a little like Pierce, actually, in that, even though maybe, the practice habits weren't perfect, although I hear Pierce is like that now. On the court, he was always given 100%, and players respect that. They're not going to care what you do off the court or in practice. If you give it everything in the game, that's really what players respect.
I also have a theory that I haven't written about yet. I'm just going to give it to you right now. I think you get a guy who's a wild card, somebody who's a little off his rocker, maybe. Those guys are always their most dangerous in their early 20s and their mid-20s. Mm-hmm. But by the late 20s, when they hit that 29 to 31 range, they're actually not that bad anymore. They've grown up. They've grown out of it a little bit. And I think we've seen with a lot of the quote-unquote head cases over the past however many years, like Iverson's a good example of somebody that, you know, by year 8, year 9, year 10 had kind of turned into a professional. You know?
Yeah, they've only lost a little bit of their athleticism, and
yeah.
I do think the league makes a lot of mistakes. They'll write once you're in sort of a box of being written off, you sort of stay there.
Yeah.
And the reality is, most of the time you're right. They're not going to come out of that box. They're probably never going to help an NBA team. But there's going to be 1 out of 10, or I don't know the right number, 1 out of 5, 1 out of 20, and those guys are missed often. I think, you know, like Vaughn Wafer this year. He's not exactly what you're describing, but he bounced around the league, was a McDonald's All-American, and people decided either they didn't like him in the draft or they didn't like him because of what they heard about his behavior early in the NBA, and so he never got a chance again, and, you know, it's been a good story for us.
Well, I look at the way I acted age 24, age 25, age 26. I mean, I had no work ethic. I went out and got drunk 4 times a week.
So
I didn't know where my life was going.
This has changed for you then, Bill?
Yeah, it's changed for me. I think, you know, I don't really think you can judge a person in their mid-20s. I don't think they start to become the person that they will become until age 29, 32. And in basketball, sometimes those might be some of the best bargains, you know?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Hey, let's talk about the Vaughn Wafer thing quickly.
Yeah.
So I'm watching TV and they say that he got Rick Adaman banished in the locker room, and then Vaughn Wafer's already dressed. He's gone. Like, what happened with that?
He's, you know, frankly, all year, he's a very, very emotional player. I mean, all NBA players have got a lot of, but he's more emotional, I'd say. He's also younger. It's his first year in the league. He's also, you know, playing for a contract. You know, as much as you'd like to think guys push that out of their minds, it's definitely something they think about. And I think, you know, more than most players, he wants to be out there for all those reasons. And, you know, whereas a guy like Brent Berry, who also wants to be out and helping us and has won 2 rings, he knows how to handle it. He's working with the younger players. He's making a positive contribution. He doesn't agree he's not getting minutes, but he's not going to let it affect the locker room or the team.
Right.
Vaughn's a young player, and he doesn't understand why the coach isn't playing him, because in his mind he should be out there. And all players go through that. I think Vaughn's just had a particular trouble with it all year, and, you know, just got demonstrative with the coach when he pulled him out. And, you know, Rick just felt like there was no place for it in a playoff game, second round. You know, he just doesn't have to deal with that.
So what's your role? You're sitting in the stands. You have your BlackBerry on. You glance at your BlackBerry. You see Vaughn go to the bench, or you see Vaughn go to the locker room. What do you do at that point? Do you get up and go in the locker room? Like, what is your role in the whole situation?
Well, I think it was the end of the third quarter. So, you know, he just went to the locker room. Then our equipment guy back there alerted me, Tony Nyla. He alerted me that maybe Vaughn wasn't handling. He was sent to the locker room. So I went back there and tried to calm him down. And we felt, based on where he was at, just the best thing would be for him to get dressed and just, you know, wait on the bus. And you know, we'd address it, you know, the next day when the emotions weren't as raw for anybody. So
did you calm him down by talking about quantum physics or Bill James's theory of wind shears?
Yeah, I'd like to think I'm deeper than that. I tried to, you know, do reflective listening. You know, something Dr. Phil would teach me. You know, I went with that strategy versus my quantum physics background.
Well, in this case, having a couple of kids probably helps you with the job. It's like dealing with one of your kids, right? They're up in their room sulking, and you have to go up and be like, all right, let's talk through this.
No, shockingly, I think that's true. And I think I've heard ESPN executives talk about you in that way, that their kids have helped them work with you, Bill. So
I am absolutely more of a head case than Vaughn Wafer. I'll be the first one to admit it. I think we've reached a point in the podcast where I admit that I owe you a little bit of an apology about all the Yao Marison jokes.
Yao Marison and Portland. How about Portland in 5?
Yeah. You know, I picked Portland. I texted you, sorry, I'm going with the Rockets. And you just said, you sent me this email back, you are crazy. this team with such a good matchup for us, and you basically laid out exactly what would happen in the series. It was impressive.
I think I said I'd make you look bad, too.
Yeah, though you did say you'd win in five, and you won in six.
Did I say five? I don't remember what I said, but we were pretty confident, probably too confident. And Roy turns out to be a little better than I thought after facing him six times. And I appreciate the crow swallowing on that because, you know, Yao, he's just a tough competitor. He is who he is. I mean, people can fault him for being not mobile enough, but if you see him as the only truly proportional 7'6" human being in the world who also has good touch, and you know, and that's worth something, and that wins a lot of games for us.
The difference in him, and I'm just an innocent bystander who follows the league, and the Rockets are just one of the 30 teams, so I wouldn't say that I am as reliable on this as a Rockets fan who's watching day in and day out for the last 7 years, but he seems hungrier to me this year. There's a fire in his eye that I do not remember seeing before. Do you agree or disagree?
Absolutely hungry. Absolutely only cares about winning.
Was the Olympics maybe part of that?
The Olympics were hard for him.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you know, going in, there's no chance. I mean, and that's why I was so excited for him in the Spain game in the Olympics, because they were up by like 20 and then they blew it at the end. And Yao actually shockingly didn't have a great game. Even though they're beating Spain. So, yeah, they were tough for him because he knew he wanted to make a good showing. They were hoping to get a medal with really no shot. And he, you know, he's just he's a great guy who works hard. When people criticize him, I'm always like trying to picture, like, if you were 7'6", how many calories, how much effort would it take just to move?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's shocking. And he beat, in game one, I've never seen this. He beat Pau Gasol down the floor.
Wow.
And had a great play. And it's an amazing thing to see. And he's a wonderful person. So the Yao Mirosan stuff hurt, but we can just call him Yao Ming from now on. That'd be great.
And, you know, I talked about this with you last summer as I was working on my book and really studying history and what kind of lessons there were from what's happened in the league already. And the thing that really was jarring to me was that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is really the only guy over 7'4" who aged well. I mean, Kareem was aged obscenely well, but most of these guys are done by the age of 28, 29. Their body just at some point just can't handle the schedule. Now, Kareem, to his credit, was doing yoga and stretching and all this stuff that had karate. Everybody was like, "What? This guy's nuts. What's he doing?" But that's the reason he played until he was 42 or 43, whatever it was. Does Yao do that stuff?
Yao works on his body a lot. I mean, there's really no book to follow. To your point, there's a lot of potential worries with some of the larger centers in the past. But again, I said it carefully. He's the only proportional 7'6" guy. He really is, you know, a 7'6" normal looking guy. I mean, all his limbs fit his body, and so we're really in uncharted territory. You know, when we talk to the doctors, he's obviously had a few injuries, and we say, "What do you think will happen?" They'll be like, "There's really no other 7'6" people for us to compare him to." So you know, he could be like, you know, Nolan Ryan was a freak of nature, pitched till he was like 48. You know, you just never know. That there's no data to go on. We're just gonna have to go on faith here.
Kareem, I think, is the closest you could go to, because Kareem was really 7'6". He claimed he was 7'2", but he was at least 7'5".
Really? I did not know.
Oh, he is absolutely.
He looked really tall in Airplane. So
yeah.
I guess I can go off comparing him to,
as Roger Murdock,
Leslie Nielsen or something. You know.
Yeah, the two guys that – actually, a few guys lied about their height. Bill Walton was another one. He didn't like the stigma of being a 7-footer, so he claimed that he was 6'11", but he was really like 7'2.5". And Kareem claimed he was 7'2", but everybody from that era says he was 7'5".
You want to know something fascinating? We actually checked this. The listed heights in college to the actual measured draft height.
Yeah.
Now, the average is it's inflated by about – 2/3 of an inch, 3/4 of an inch, which you'd expect. But what's shocking is a full 1/3 of the people list a height shorter than they actually are.
Really?
Yeah, 1/3. So you got these guys who really inflate it, and then you've got more Kevin Garnetts than you might expect. Maybe people trying to fit into, you know, whatever draft perception of the size should be for that role.
Mm.
Or you've got lazy sports information directors at the colleges who, or you got unaware players who don't realize they should list themselves taller. For whatever reason, if you go back through history, it's a shocking number of guys listed themselves shorter than their actual height.
Didn't you say Carl Landry was one of those guys?
Carl Landry was one of those guys, yeah, absolutely.
Wasn't he listed as like 6'7" and a half, and you measured him and he was like 6'9" and a half?
We didn't even measure. We measured at the combine, which is sort of the official measurement.
Yeah.
And, you know, with shoes, he's 6'9", and yeah, he was listing himself at 6'8", so, which is normally guys list themselves with shoes and even add an inch to that.
There's so many insulting heights, though, like Ben Gordon, I think, lists himself as 6'3". He's not even 6 feet. Iverson was like 5'10". Iverson always listed himself as 6 feet or 6'1". I can't remember. And then the best one ever was Barkley at 6'6".
But yeah, Barkley's like my 6'3". Height, I think.
Yeah, he's like 6'3", 6'2 and a half.
Gave me hope I could play in the league.
Too
bad I didn't have the huge ass and the freakish athleticism. But.
You had the elbows. You could have been like a Lambeer type. Possibly.
I'm one of the few people who liked Bill Lambeer. I don't know if that's possible, but
have you been following any of the other playoff teams, or are you just wrapped up in the Rocket series?
I've been watching games where I can. I'd probably catch a quarter and a half here and there of the.
Anything surprise you?
Does
Denver surprise you at all? Denver's better than I think.
I was
definitely better than
one moment I remember was very depressing. Was watching one of the East playoff series, which I won't name, and just knowing we'd win in four, and then how we're having to struggle, you know, which is, you know, I don't think I am for reseeding. I don't remember if you are, but, you know, just knowing that we could have an easier road, different spots. I think Denver's surprised me a little. I mean, I guess you could predict it in that, you know, Nene's having his career year, Kenyon Martin's rejuvenated.
But Nene is better than he was. Nene was not playing at this level during the season, in my opinion.
Yeah, he's like that Disney movie where the kid got the new, you know, the surgery and came back with the 100-mile-per-hour arm. Yeah,
I thought him and Dampier, I thought he'd have a slight edge, but I thought maybe for the most part it's going to be a wash. And instead, it's the pivotal matchup of the series, and it's why the Nuggets are going to win because they have no answer for Nene.
You know, and Chris Anderson was a great pickup. I voted for Mark Workentine for Executive of the Year because he just did a tremendous job, I thought, just in pickups. And obviously that Billups trade was tremendous. And he did it all while getting his owner under the luxury tax, which, you know, all the GMs in the league know how big of a deal that is for the owners. And
we were talking about that, you and me privately, that just him getting them from $90 million to $70 million should have won him Executive of the Year. But then to keep them as a playoff team is, like, amazing.
For some owners, I mean, you know, not I'd say every team in the league now operates to that number, so it's, you know, because it's so punitive. You know, the league's made it so punitive to go over that.
Yeah.
It becomes a big part of the job is how do you get these good players to fit in the little box they give you of the luxury tax.
When Tracy wanted to sit on the bench in round one, were you like, geez, Tracy, or is it like, is everything good with him?
Everything's good. Everything's good. I know your Yao Mirasan side wants to create something there, but he had microfracture surgery. You don't fake microfracture surgery, you know, like
right.
I think some people are talking about, and he's working hard to get back, and, you know, really, we're making our best push without him, but obviously with him, we'd have obviously a piece we need to, help us beat the Lakers here.
So that next year's team will look a little different.
Well, next year's team, I think there's some optimism on some of the doctors looked at his knee. He could be back as early as the start of the year. I think, you know, really the answer is nobody knows how long these surgeries take with each person. The heal rate on the cartilage is a different rate. So, you know, we're hoping it's earlier. It could be later. It could, you know, it definitely should be at some point next year, and then it'll be, you know, it would be one of those good problems to have, I think, of how to integrate them back in.
Are you excited that the economy has turned to the point that in any other year somebody would overpay Ron Artest this summer, but this year that actually might not happen? You might get to keep him?
It'll be interesting. Baseball sort of, you know, they lead the way on a lot of things, and they led the way. I think we might see some similar dynamics there where, you know, almost like a falling housing market where, you know, no agent wants to be the first one to sign that under-market deal. So it just freezes everything up and everything drags out. I could see a similar thing happening because there just aren't going to be a lot of teams with money this summer.
Yeah.
And it's not just us, you know, who benefits. It's every team in the league, you know, who's going to benefit because, you know, not a lot of teams have a lot of room. And so, the free agents this summer, cap potentially going down, I think it's obviously not known for sure, but it's probably going to be around flat. So at least flat, it's not probably going to go up like it has in the past. I think it's going to put a squeeze on the free agency period.
Well, and as we know, that all sounds good, but it only takes like one or two teams to screw it up for everybody.
That's true. That happens every year, too. I mean, there's always the, oh, my God, who signed that deal moment.
Oh, Lord, don't you realize what you just did?
we'll often talk about those offline.
Yeah.
In terms of the ones we just are just real head scratchers. And every once in a while we'll both be wrong about one that ends up being good.
No, but we're never wrong. I haven't been wrong in 5 years.
I think one of your catchphrases is, as we all know, you know, I don't know anything or something.
The VP of Common Sense?
Well, the VP of Common Sense is one of your best inventions, and I have to credit you. It is used, at least here. I'm guessing maybe some other teams have adopted it, and we actually have a designated VP of Common Sense within the organization.
Well, besides me? I thought I was your VP.
You're the unbiased outsider VP of Common Sense.
Okay,
we have an insider who, you know, every once in a while give me a whack and, you know, pull us away from all our analysis and be like, you know, do you realize what we're talking about?
Yeah.
It's a good role to have, and we actually consciously talk about it.
You only defied me once, and I won't mention what happened, but there was one time where we vehemently disagreed on something, and then I was proven correct. So now you have to actually win that back.
We talked about yours, so you can reveal mine, unless it's so horrible. Then,
no, I really wanted you to trade Tracy last summer.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, obviously, if you know everything's going to happen, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of fluky because he got hurt. So it's like we'll never really know what the right move was. But
well, we still feel, I mean, the history of the league would show you need two guys as talented as Yao and Tracy. And, you know, with Yao out, it's tougher for us. We've got to be perfect with almost every other dollar we're spending, with almost every other player on the team.
Mm.
And there's really only one team that hasn't won with, you know, the two elite players, if you go back, and you know, obviously depending on how you define it, but the way we look at it, and that's Detroit, and we've talked about it, that was, you know, you felt like that was a down year for the league.
Yeah,
so.
Weird year, the rules, they hadn't fixed the rules yet, and that Lakers team, you know, if Karl Malone doesn't get hurt, and they're not just completely imploding, I don't know. I think if you play that season, if you simulated it 10 times, the Lakers probably win 9. You know what I mean? It was just a weird year. And then the next year, the Artest goes in the stands, and Indiana arguably had the best team. And that leads to that weird year, which was San Antonio, Detroit in the finals. Neither team was really that good. It's, luck and chance plays a lot bigger of a deal with this stuff than you think. And that's one of the things, like, you study, just go through the seasons. Like, the 73 Celtics don't win the title because Havlicek separates his shoulder in the Easter Finals. The 76 Celtics win the title with a much worse team because Rick Barry gets mad at his teammates in Game 7 of the Western Finals, and they end up not making the finals. And so you just, there's all these little weird tipping points that you just can't see.
And to me, that's why we try and keep ourselves competitive. I mean, you really have to be over 50 wins to be, you know, even think about winning the title.
Yeah.
And we've done that, I think, 4 of the past 5 years, at least 3 of the past 4. And, you know, you wish you were the top team in the league coming in. Obviously, that was the Lakers and Cavaliers this year.
Right.
But you know, you get in it. You never know. There's an injury. You know, we might match up really well against your opponent. You might get an easier road to the finals, like I think Cleveland might have gotten here.
Yeah, it looks that way, yeah.
But, you know, it looks that way. You couldn't know that before. So I do think there's some advantage to being, you know, in the mix, being the top 4 to 6 teams every year. We felt like we were in that area. And I thought 3 of the top 6 teams in the league were in our little bracket, you know, the Lakers, Portland, and us. I thought we were 3 of the top 6 teams. So I thought that was unfortunate. We all got, you know, because I do think Portland probably was a good enough team to advance to the second round.
Yeah, just so you look at the last couple of years, 05, Pacers get knocked out because of the R testing. 06, does Miami beat the Spurs in a series? Like, you forget, the Spurs are up 3 in a game 7. Dirk comes plowing in the lane. Ginobili stupidly fouls, and they end up losing in overtime. And then Miami beats Dallas in the finals. I don't know if they beat San Antonio. Duncan's had a lot of success against Shaq. Then you look at last year, the Celtics get in there. The Lakers, you know, everybody, wow, look at the Lakers. Oh, my God. And they beat him in 6. But you just, as long as you're kind of sniffing around, you just don't know, you know?
Yeah, I think you have to be realistic if you're outside of the top 6 to 8 teams and know the situation you're in and not, you know, make some Band-Aid moves on something that's not going to help. But if you're near the top, I mean, we were before we finally got out of the first round, we were always criticized for not getting out of the first round. I was like, well, what about all the teams that don't make it every year? Like, why?
Right.
Like, why don't we talk about those teams? Like, we're at least winning 50 games, you know?
Yeah, there's 3 levels. You're either 50 games and over and you're in the mix. 50 wins and over, you're in the mix. Or you're 32 wins and under and you're in that mix of we're going to rebuild this way. The spot you don't want to be in is the 32 to 46 range.
Yeah, it's a tough spot.
We're just good enough to lose in round 1, but we're not good enough to bottom out. And what do we do?
Yeah, and you get lower picks where there's no talent, and you just get into, like, this spin cycle that's tough. And I do think you can get out of it by being smart with your, you know, free agents and trades. But it does put a burden on the franchise to get out of that zone.
What do you think of my candidacy for the Minnesota Timberwolves GM? I guess laughter isn't a good start.
Well, I'm channeling Shane Battier. He gives a nice laugh before every question he answers.
Okay, that's smart.
I'd heard someone in here advocated it. You have a strong advocate within the Rockets organization.
Beautiful. I do have some advocates sprinkled around.
Yeah, you do. And well, you have a lot of Twitter followers, so you must be popular somewhere. And
thank you.
And his argument was that you'd sell a lot of tickets, and I think that was your argument. But I don't know. I've been to Minnesota. I worked in Minneapolis, actually Eagan, for about a year, and I don't know if you sell a lot of tickets, Bill. I mean, I think in Boston,
I don't know if I sell tickets. I think I generate interest in the team that maybe normally wouldn't be there, especially nationally.
Would you generate sustainable interest?
If it was working, here's my thing.
Well, if it was working, true, but I'm just like, you argued that the novelty of hiring someone, you know, with your background, obviously my background is different too, but you argue the novelty would generate interest for a while.
I'd have to do well in the job.
Yeah. I don't think they could just hire you because You're a novelty, is my point.
No, but that's a nice starter, and then I'd have to actually do well in the job. Right,
right, yeah. Exactly.
You are my best test case because you are a guy that made his bones outside of basketball. You worked for one NBA team. You didn't play college basketball. You didn't play pro basketball. You didn't coach. When you got hired, everybody was like, what the hell are the Rockets doing? Why are they hired this 33-year-old MIT guy? Like, what the, you know, it was on the
True.
Message board. It almost caused a riot.
I was trying to get advice on how to stop all the awful articles from coming out. And
yeah, I mean, you got pigeonholed as like, uh-oh, they just hired some nerd. This is ridiculous, this guy. And then you have all the people, the old school basketball network guys, like, just poo-pooing you. And then you basically shoved it in everybody's face 2 years later. Aaron Brooks, number 28 pick. Carl Landry, run our test trade. Like, you've done a good job, and you're not a conventional GM. You're not.
Well, I don't know if we've done much yet. I mean, we're just finally getting out of the first round, so I feel like we can at least say we've done something. But obviously our goals are bigger, and you know, until those happen, I'm not going to say we've done that good of a job.
No, but you've done a good job. Just, you don't have to admit it, but I'm telling you that you've done a good job, and I think the most important thing you've done, and you don't get credit for it, whatever, is you've kind of proven that there's no one way to do this job. Your job is to evaluate players in the best possible ways you can evaluate them. This was a theme that kept coming up at the Sloan Conference. It's, there's no bad way to do this. You can spend $100,000 on some statistical study and it might not tell you anything. That doesn't mean it was wrong to spend that $100,000 because you're trying to figure out as much information as you can.
Right. And I think Danny does that really well. It's one thing I learned from him is I respect him a lot because as someone who came up, who was one of the best athletes of all time, who was a former player in multiple sports, who was all these things, he could have been like a traditional, you know, more traditional GM, but he really chose to embrace anything that would give him an edge, which I think you could see in his play. And so he's done an incredible job to really show that he could take, you know, what's a traditional background and not, you know, sort of pigeonhole himself. And I think, to your point, what I always tell people, Bill, and this is where I think you could do a good job and where I think a lot of folks who are listening could do a very good job, is it's really about decision-making, and it's really about understanding, you know, it's really about understanding risk and understanding the state of your franchise. And if you can make good decisions in any field, really, you know, it's going to take some time. I know one of your friends, Malcolm Gladwell, talked, it's going to take you some time to get up to speed in terms of having watched enough games and to really understand the nuances of the game. But once you get there, if you're, you know, if you're someone who's smart and thoughtful and works hard, I think a lot of people can do a very good job. And I say all the time, because my route here had a lot of serendipity to it, that there are a lot of very, very talented people who have never gotten off the bench to use a basketball. They're never, you know, they were like Von Wafer. They floated around and no one ever gave them a shot. But I think if they got a shot, they might have, you know, a lot of people could do a very good job.
Yeah, and you made an interesting point about one of the problems with this job is that these guys don't have fallback plans. Like for you, let's say you get fired tomorrow. You're going to find a job somewhere else. You have skills that could lend itself to a variety of different businesses, which in a way releases some of the pressure on you. You can actually think long term and take some chances. But if I'm so-and-so at so-and-so team and I get fired and I'm not going to work again and I have no real backup plan other than maybe catching on as a broadcaster, I think there's a little bit of a malaise that sets in, maybe a little more afraid to take the chance. I don't know if a lot of GMs would add the balls to trade for Ron Artest, honestly.
Well, I think I wouldn't call it a malaise. Well, I would say I think it's changing. I think the executives in the league, you know, are extremely good. And every year, I think you've noticed
there's
this
more,
too, is the draft gets better and better. Like, and it's more, it's, it just gets harder and harder. It used to be like late in the first, it felt like there's always a guy here or there. And I still think if you do your work, you can maybe find him. But every year, the list of guys who are picked just gets closer and closer to who we think is good, and it's hard. It makes it even harder.
The league got smarter the last 5 years. There's no question.
Yeah, exactly. But I would say it's a malaise. I do think because only one team out of 30 wins, you do have to be risk seeking in the job, and you do have to roll the dice because, yeah, otherwise you'll get caught in that spin cycle in that area of winning 40 to 45 games. And so you've got to take good calculated risks. And I do think, you know, in the past, I wouldn't say now, but in the past, there might have been, you know, some worry of someone just trying to protect their job, maybe wasn't willing to roll the dice like they should.
Well, the one thing that seems to happen even now is teams locking up guys who aren't necessarily, like, paying number one money for a guy who's not a number one. Paying number two money for a guy who's maybe the fourth best guy on a championship team. Because they're trying to lock something down so that they could say, all right, well, at the very least, we have these guys and we're going to be pretty good and I'm not going to get fired. That's why I appreciated what Sam Presti did so much with the team that shall not be named. He gutted the team. He traded Ray Allen, the best player, and he built around the draft picks and he built around cap space. And now I think that team is in as good position as anybody in the league over the next 10 years.
He's done an unbelievable job, and he, I think one of the things that he did that, you know, is really, I guess I was happy that someone gave him a Executive of the Year vote, mm-hmm. because it's not the kind of person who normally does. It's normally, you know, more like a Mark Warkentin, who I voted for because I thought he deserved it. And I did think about voting for Sam as well because I think he's done a great – there's been a lot of good jobs. Kevin Pritchard's done a great job. Danny's obviously done a good job. So I thought about a lot of people, but Sam, I was happy for Sam to get a vote because it was the kind of a job that isn't appreciated normally. And he's set the franchise up really, really well with a franchise guy with Durant now.
Yeah.
And then just a lot of very good players and he's chosen the ones to build around, and he's going to keep searching for the rest of the pieces.
Well, he followed the Spurs motto and he followed the Celtics motto, which is something that you can't totally follow yet just because of the roster that you have. So you went about it a little differently, but you lock down those best three and then you surround them with guys that complement what those best three do. So basically, you're selecting your best three. You're making sure they're all good guys. You're making sure they're all talented. You're making sure they're properly paid. And that's your foundation. And I think, you know, miraculously, I think he already has the three guys, Durant, Westbrook, and Jeff Green. Maybe Jeff Green's the fourth best guy on a title team, maybe borderline three, I don't know. But it's pretty good if you throw in that lottery pick this year.
Yeah, and odds are, you know, frankly, it's that it isn't the right three, frankly, because only one team gets to win every year. But he's certainly taken bets on – it's really about taking bets, and he's certainly taken bets on good guys. And one of my favorite – and you don't do this, but one of my favorite journalistic tricks that's out there is they'll be like, well, those two guys, they'll never win a title. Well, duh.
Like, right.
Only one team wins every year. So, yeah, you're going to be right a lot. You know,
right.
Just write that every day, and you're going to sound smart, and you're going to be right most of the time. And I used to say, everyone's like, Yao and Tracy will never win. And I'll be like, you know what, odds are you're right, but we still think that's our best bet, and we still think it's a pretty good bet. And,
yeah, thanks for telling us that the odds of something that has a 29 and 30 chance of happening is probably going to happen.
Exactly.
You grew up in Cleveland. The Cavs are just rolling through everybody. You're a big Cavs fan growing up. You love Mark Price more than any man has ever loved Mark Price.
That's true. All true.
Little weird, bittersweet for you here?
You know, it's just because I worked for the Celtics, and my affinity was to those Daugherty, Nance, Hot Rod, Price, you know, Craig Elo, Mike Sand, you know, that
yeah.
team. I lost some of the affinity, and so now it's just a competitive team, really, for me.
All right.
So I do appreciate watching LeBron.
You're happy for everybody back home, though.
Yeah, I'm happy for them, and you know, happy for. I think Cleveland's had a lot of suffering, so for them to win a title, I think they'll be their first title since the Indians in '54. I think the Browns technically won a title before there was a Super Bowl.
Well, you know how you have your Morey rule? That's like, you know, what is it like the number of. Is it from Bill James or you, whatever the rule is about your down
pipe? Bill has his own that is a little more conservative. Mine is just a rough, if you have the same number or more points than minutes left in the game, you're doing pretty good. You got like an 85% chance to win, roughly.
All right, well, I'm going to introduce the Simmons rule here, and I don't even know if it's true or not. But
yeah, that never stops you.
Well, I'm going to throw it out there, and then I'm going to actually, maybe I'll go back and try to research it, but if you're winning your playoff games by 20 to 25 points a game and nobody is ever taking a lead of more than like 2 points over you, it's a good chance you're going to be in the finals.
Well,
I'm going to throw that out there.
I think it's a solid rule, Bill. I think you're in safe territory.
Well, that's why Denver's intriguing, because it's not just that they're winning these games. They're blowing out teams. They've now won 6 games by double digits, and I think 4 or 5 of those games by like 20, 25. They win a game by 58. At some point, I think we have to start thinking, all right, wait a second. Is this team just really, really good and we just don't want to admit it? Like, I don't know.
It's very hard to build up big leads in this league. And
yeah.
So that does tell you a huge amount about a team.
And conversely, I think you have – there's got to be some way to study this, but if you have separating games into halves, if you have halves that you lose by 15 points or more, and this keeps happening over and over again, I think that's a really bad sign for your team, which is why I'm so confident with the Celtics against the Magic. The Magic will just have these halves where they just get blown out, and I don't think that can happen routinely.
Well, it's a tough thing with the high three-point teams, which Orlando, I think, was number two this year in
right.
most three-pointers. They were close to one. They're top three for sure. Is, you know, the three-pointer is a good shot, obviously, when it's open especially. But the reality is, even good teams, you can go through long droughts. And it creates a risk for a good team that you might hit that game where you miss them, and it's tough. And, you know, and I think Orlando, I voted for Stan Van Gundy for Coach of the Year because I just think he took, you know, their talent is not to the level of a team that won as many games as they won.
I agree.
I just felt like he as a coach, I think it's very hard to create, you know, maybe more than 3 to 5 wins over the course of a season. And I think he was one of the few coaches that got maybe above 5.
And it's also hard to create 15 to 20 extra losses a season, but I watched Mike Dunleavy do that with the Clippers. So
and I'll
excited.
Be clear, I can't vote for my own guy. I'm not allowed to, so I don't get in trouble.
Last question. You grew up an Indians fan. You follow Manny during the embryonic Manny being Manny stages, and you liked him a great deal. How disappointed were you yesterday?
You know, it was the first time I felt all the emotions, I think, that have felt by nearly every other baseball fan over the past 4 years.
Mm.
At this point, I was always this person who was an interested party watching the steroid scandal.
Yeah.
You know, it was sort of like I watched the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I sort of read about it here and there, but it doesn't affect my life. I hope it would resolve itself, but I'm not, every day I'm not worrying about it.
Yeah.
This one hit home because he was such maybe the most gifted hitter I've ever seen, and it never felt like he needed that, or I don't know, I'm still bothered by it because, you know, I just remember it was during the period when I was the Indians, they drafted him, he's from the Bronx, he was going to be the savior, I was watching his numbers as like a, you know, early on, obviously, was big into, you know, watching the numbers in baseball and just saying, this guy's going to be a monster.
Yeah.
He came up, and just him and Tomei and Baerga, the whole team was a fun team to watch. And, you know, I didn't want to believe anything bad about any of them. And Manny obviously had the quirky personality, but never had anything like this. So it bothered me.
State, you were a big baseball stat dork like myself growing up. Do you think there's a way we could figure out some sort of formula for the steroids era, which is probably from, I don't know, 93 to 08? Is there a way we could figure out some adjusted stats?
That's been looked at by teams and by outside folks. So Steve Levitt, who wrote Freakonomics, he had someone look at that. I know teams look at it because they don't want a free agent sign someone who's going to, you know, just fall apart because it was because of steroids. And as far as I know, I mean, there may be a team that's done it because then they wouldn't talk about it. But I haven't talked to anyone who's cracked the puzzle and, you know, found a specific way to do it. It seems like it shouldn't be that hard, but I've not, you know, like Brady Anderson hits 50, you go like, you know?
Right.
So I just, to me, that seems like that shouldn't be that hard, but apparently it is, and I haven't looked at it myself. But the people who have looked at it, I respect, so it must be harder than I would expect.
Well, what would be interesting to me is if there is some way to figure out if there was an absurd variance in specific stats compared to the rest of the guy's career. Like, for instance, if you take, Jim Rice in 1977, and he only did that 1 year instead of for three, where he hit 330, 325, 45 homers, 140 RBIs, whatever. And it only happened 1 year instead of three, and it was totally out of proportion to the rest of his career. Is there some sort of I hate to use the word tipping point for the third time in the podcast, but is there a tipping point number that could make the season seem fishy?
I mean? I think there's sort of a volatility, and there's a bunch of ways to do it, and I know I have some ideas how I'd go at the problem, but I think they're the same ones that people have tried, and I guess it's just hard to separate, especially on the pitcher side, it's hard to separate a guy learned a split finger fastball over the winter, and from he took steroids. I think that has been just too hard to separate.
Yeah. I'd be interested. If anybody can do it, we've seen these statistical minds of one of you, that's where you came out of. But these guys can figure out almost anything at this point. It's kind of crazy. Especially in basketball, I've been very surprised that they've been able to figure out these defensive stats as well as they have, although you still won't give me any of the information.
Yeah, we're keeping it back. So
do you keep open 3-point field goal percentage?
Yeah, we have everything you'd want, Bill.
Oh, so. I hate you. You got to just give me like a team employee account. Let me just go on there and check it all out. All right, Daryl Morey, good luck. Good luck tonight. Good luck in the series. Obviously I'm rooting for you guys. And if
you're not rooting for Kobe, you love Kobe so much.
Oh, it's for me, it's the perfect storm. I love you and the Lakers are my least favorite team. So it's like, this is obviously, where my interests are. And I do feel bad that I wagered against you last round. I feel like I betrayed you in some way.
That's all right.
I won't do that again.
All right.
Good luck.
Talk to you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Target the saddle.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
You laughed, you cried, you turned up the sound repeatedly, and now it's all over. This concludes another installment of the BS Report. And with all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important just-breaking news.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin.
The $5 foot-long anthem rolls on with Subway Everyday Value. So many of your Subway favorites are $5 footlongs, like that Tastetacular Spicy Italian $5 footlong and the piled ridiculously high BLT $5 footlong, both made to your order on the freshly baked bread of your choice.